Hi, it's Brendan here. Before we kick off with this week's episode, I want to invite you to my next very special live recording of this podcast. On Thursday, 21st of March at 7 p.m, I will be joined by the brilliant Matt Ridley, a science writer and the co-author of Viral, The Search for the Origin of COVID-19. Matt and I will be live and in conversation via Zoom, talking about the cover-up of the lab leak theory, the dire consequences of lockdown, the perils of net zero, and other things too. We'll also be taking questions from you, the audience, so if you have something you want to ask Matt, now is your chance. This is a free event exclusive to Spiked supporters, our online donor community. If you're already a Spiked supporter, you can sign up for your ticket now on our online donor hub. If you're not already a Spiked supporter, now is the perfect time to become one. For as little as £5 a month, you can get your ticket to this event, plus you'll enjoy loads of other exclusive perks like ad-free reading, access to our comments section, and to other free events like this one. To become a Spiked supporter, go to www.spiked-online.com/supporters. That's www.spiked-online.com/supporters. I'll see you there on Thursday, the 21st of March at 7 p.m. with Matt Ridley.
People don't even question therapists. They assume they can only help. And we have, as a result, the most vastly dysregulated, anxious, depressed, and honestly incapacitated kids. These young people, they think that every bit of nervousness is social anxiety. Every bit of sadness is depression. Every bad memory is PTSD suddenly. Telling a generation that they've been traumatized is so much more profound and harmful than even the trauma itself.
Hello, welcome back to the Brendan O'Neill Show with me, Brendan O'Neill, and my special guest this week, Abigail Schreier. Abigail, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on.
It's great to have you on. I've wanted you on for a long time, and now we have the perfect excuse because you have this brilliant new book out called Bad Therapy: Why the Kids Aren't Growing Up. There is so much in this book. There are so many ideas and pieces of information and anecdotes that blew my mind and made me very worried, I have to be honest, about the new generation and what's going on. It's an uncompromising examination of the therapy industry, I guess, especially as it pertains to young people. And you really make the case that it has not actually turned out a happier, more content, more placid generation, but actually one that is pretty neurotic and unhappy and a bit depressed and so on. So it's an excellent book. There's a lot in it and there's a lot I want to ask you about. But I guess I want to kick off by just asking you how bad things have got in the United States in relation to the therapeutic idea and the way in which it's aimed at children in particular. Just how bad is the situation there?
It's terrible. You know, people don't even question therapists or, you know, they assume they can only help. They assume these things that don't make any sense, that therapy has the power to do good, but also it can never harm. And that in itself doesn't make any sense. If any intervention, no matter how good, if it has the power to help, can also have the power to harm. And they hand their children over, and this is the key problem. They hand their children over to therapists, but also school teachers who are practicing therapy, school mental health staff that are treating kids to a kind of therapy. They are behaving in their parenting as quasi-therapists. And they don't realize, first of all, that it's very different with kids, that these therapeutic practices with kids are so much worse than they are with adults. It's not the same. And we can get into why, but the biggest thing I want parents to do is take a step back and question, which of course doesn't mean never avail yourself of these resources. It just means I'd like to reset, if I could, the default settings, which is don't rush for the diagnosis for your child. Don't immediately start them on antidepressants. Don't immediately assume that they really have ADHD. Just take a moment and question it.
On that question of questioning things, I think that's a really important part of this discussion. And I want to talk to you about an anecdote that you opened the book with, which I found really shocking. I found it so chilling. And I'm someone who has been criticizing the therapy industry for some time, or at least feeling uncomfortable with the excesses of it here in the UK as well as in the US. But even I found this anecdote really chilling. So your young son comes back from camp and he's got a stomach ache. So you take him off to see a doctor to see what's going on there. And the next thing is that he very nearly was submitted to a mental health analysis, a mental health test, where they were going to ask him questions like, have you ever wished you were dead? Have you ever considered taking your own life? To me, the idea of a young kid whose ailment is a stomachache, nothing to do with a mental health problem, the idea that a young kid would be asked questions like that, I found really shocking. I would be scared if I was asked questions like that. That would make me feel very uncomfortable, never mind a child. What did you feel when that happened? Was that one of the triggers that made you think, I need to look into this? I need to look into how prevalent and problematic this therapy for kids is becoming.
You know, the truth is I had already written the entire book when that happened. And I was, and here's the part that shocked me. I was about to get up and leave the room because he asked me to leave the room so he could do our mental health screener. I had written this book and even I was going to get up because a doctor had, you know, a nurse had asked me to do something. This was their standard protocol. The questionnaire was put out by a federal agency, the National Institute of Mental Health, and I was still not going to question it. And then I said, well, hold on, can I see your survey? And it's a series of five escalating questions about whether a child might want to kill himself. And the idea that someone who would put this in front of a child, first ask the parents to leave the room, and then put this in front of the child, that they are some kind of expert in kids' mental health is extraordinary. I mean, if anything, it deserves just another reason to take a hard look at how well have they done? And the answer is they've done astonishingly poorly. In fact, they've made the mental health of young people much worse.
So one of the things that you touch on in the book, which is, I think, such an interesting way of coming at this, which is the, I guess, the pathologization of normal aspects of kids' lives. So the kind of things that our generation, there's a great book in the book where you describe growing up as a normal kid in the 80s, and I want to come onto that in a moment. But our generation and older generations would have considered things like shyness to be a pretty normal thing in a child, right? You were a shy kid. Or a picky eater, for example, or a kid who was clumsy or overactive or annoying. You know, these kids had all these normal trends, and an adult would just say, he's shy, she's overactive, he needs to calm down, whatever. But recently we've witnessed the pathologization of all of those perfectly normal traits of the average human kid. So shyness is now, I don't know what it's called, social disorder or whatever it is.
Social anxiety, social phobia.
Kids are being diagnosed with ADHD left, right, and center. I love your example of how picky eaters are now referred to as food avoidant. I just think to myself, imagine the kid when I was at school being referred to as food avoidant. So all of these new terms have been introduced, and this has been happening for a long time. And we've seen the growth of pathology categories that are increasingly medicalizing what were traditionally seen as normal emotions, both in adults and kids, and they're now treated as symbols of ailments or sicknesses. To what extent do you think this pathologization is a key part of the problem or a key expression of the problem, where it even becomes difficult to talk about normal life without sounding like you're medicalizing someone?
That's right. That's why I say the mental health industry is to blame, because these kids have complete, that those are the concepts in which they describe themselves and describe each other. They don't even know this is normal, part of growing up. They think that every bit of nervousness is social anxiety. As you said, every bit of sadness is depression. Every bit of, you know, a bad memory is PTSD suddenly. And it's making them weaker, because the thing is, and this is what I want parents to know, when you think you have a mental disorder, okay, when you label it, all of a sudden you're limited by it. You have a brain problem. It's not like shyness, which all of us have to overcome and all of us feel sometimes. Now, the only thing, you lose your agency because you think to yourself, now only treatment can cure me. And I'm not saying don't you know, ever label actual severe disorders. Sometimes we need to, but when we don't need to, that's the problem. That's where you're only getting the risk. And that's what we're seeing.
So let's talk a bit about how this industry came about, and then we can talk about some of the awful impacts that it has on the young generation. There's a really good bit in the book where you describe growing up in the 80s, and if you misbehaved, you got spanked. And if you complained about what was on the table for dinner, no one paid a blind bit of notice. You ate your dinner or you didn't eat your dinner. If your views weren't taken seriously in a family discussion, that was perfectly normal. And it's such a wonderful descriptive part of the book, and every part of it rang true with me. When I was a kid growing up in London, in a fairly traditional Irish heritage household, we were spanked, we were sent to our room, we were told off, sometimes quite severely. We knew that there were authority figures in our lives, and that because we were kids, what we said sometimes didn't matter, and how we behaved sometimes had to be disciplined and reprimanded. So that was seen as perfectly normal. So how is it that that generation, our generation, most of whom had fairly normal upbringings in which we recognized that being a kid was different to being an adult, how have they become the leaders in many ways of this new therapeutic industry, which now tells kids that they're sick and they're fragile and they're vulnerable and they have to be mollycoddled and they have to be protected? How did that come about?
Well, largely because we thought back to the moments in our childhood, and there often weren't many. If you looked across our childhood, but the moments where we felt under-supported and misunderstood, and then we sort of magnified that, and met very often with the help of therapists, we became convinced that any time we weren't, perfectly understood or supported, that caused us trauma, and we were living with it still. And the problem with that is, of course, we came to assume not only that that was everyday life, we had to constantly feel what our kids were feeling and extend them compassion and affirm what they were feeling. What we didn't understand, we thought this was the kindest thing to do. What we didn't understand was that it's often the cruelest, because when you minimize a child's worries, you're also signaling to the kid, you can brush this off. It's not a big deal. And very often a child will look to the parents to decide, do I have to be worried about this? They don't know. And most of the time when a parent signals to a child, that's not a big deal, you're going to be fine, the child can rise to the occasion. Now, of course, there are going to be times when a child's broken a leg and can't stand. And that's different. But most of the time, looking to you and telling a child, you're going to be fine, get back on and, you know, play on, that's actually the kindest message, because it asks the child to, you know, pull up their inner resources, and they have them. And then they're going to discover that they have them, and they're going to remember that for the rest of their lives. And I think this is a dramatic overcorrection that we've seen. And we have, as a result, the most vastly dysregulated, anxious, depressed, and honestly, incapacitated kids. These young people, they don't feel they can make a positive difference in the world. That's how weak they feel, or inefficacious. It's a real problem.
I was thinking, as you were speaking there, it's so true that a lot of what we might now misinterpret as harshness in our own childhoods, or a kind of cavalier approach by parents or teachers as well, was actually them saying, look, you can do it. You can sort this problem out for yourself. I remember at my school, for example, we were often told by teachers, don't tell tales. So if you went to a teacher and said, look, I'm having a tough time in the playground, we were often told, teachers would often say, we don't want to hear this. Don't snitch on your fellow kids. Get out there, sort it out, fix it. It seemed like a pretty harsh thing at the time. And of course, serious cases of bullying were dealt with seriously. I'm not saying that kids were at liberty to really bully their classmates. But if it was a playground scrap, or someone was ejected from the friends circle, or you just fell out with someone and you were very upset about it, we were very often encouraged to work it out for ourselves, because those are the arenas, I guess, through which a child is socialized into something approaching autonomy and resilience and being able to fix problems in something approaching an adult way. When that's taken away and when kids are instead encouraged to report every single trial and tribulation they face and to see everything as potentially traumatic and to see experts as necessary for them to navigate normal life, that must be incredibly debilitating, I guess, for the new generation.
That's right. They don't feel up to the responsibilities of adulthood and they're opting out. They don't want to show up for work. They don't want to be parents. They don't want to get married. They don't want to even move out of their parents' house. And at rates we've never seen before. You know, you were mentioning that there's a wonderful Irish therapist named Stella O'Malley, who I talked to. And one of the things she pointed out to me was that parents were minimizing the very real difficulties they were facing. Dad lost his job or things that their parents had gone through for the sake of their children and magnifying the children's worries. So they were taking their children's worries so seriously and also keeping from them the hard things that their parents and grandparents had gone through. Well, that just takes the monster under the bed and makes him so much scarier. And that's the problem. When you constantly affirm a child's worries, you're sending a child down the spiraling path of greater worry and greater fear. And at the moment where they're just trying to calibrate, is this something I need to be concerned about?
As Spike, we know that plenty of you would love to break free from your 9-to-5. Imagine saying goodbye to long commutes and instead being able to do things your own way. But we also know that starting a business is tricky. Lucky for you, there's a way to make it easy, and it sounds like this. That's the sound of another sale on Shopify, the groundbreaking all-in-one commerce platform that gives you the power to be your own boss. Shopify empowers up-and-coming entrepreneurs like you all over the world. Whether you trade in Post-it notes or giant parade floats, Shopify can simplify how you sell goods both online and in-store. Turning those big ideas into reality has never been so easy. Shopify brings your entire enterprise under one intuitive dashboard. This makes shipping and managing goods absolutely effortless. That means you'll have all the time you need to come up with great new ideas and focus on the big picture. Shopify also connects your business with social media marketplaces from Facebook to TikTok. Regardless of who you're selling to, Shopify will help you reach them. And don't worry about losing your unique image. Shopify's simple customization tools give you the freedom to constantly innovate your brand. What direction you take remains completely in your hands. So what are you waiting for? If you want total business independence, get started with Shopify today. Sign up for a £1 per month trial period at shopify.co.uk/Brendan. That's all lowercase. shopify.co.uk/Brendan to take your business to the next level today. That's shopify.co.uk/Brendan. I wanted to ask you about the relationship between trauma and resilience in relation to kids, because one of the things that we are often told these days is that children are very easily traumatized, that they can experience all facets of life as potentially traumatizing and they can internalize that trauma. And you write about this in your book, the idea that they might internalize the trauma and bring it with them all through life. There's a real problem with understanding even genuinely traumatic experiences in that way, isn't there? Because people will know, many listeners will know, that even very traumatic experiences in one's childhood, from the fairly minor, like the death of a pet, which can be serious, but it's also not the biggest problem in the world, through to the death of a parent, which is very serious. I mean, there can be traumatic events in a child's life, but they are often contributors to a sense of resilience and a sense that one can overcome these problems, learn to live with them, develop the necessary skills for negotiating life, even in the face of traumatic or difficult experiences. When trauma is seen as something that is all pervasive and necessarily detrimental to your whole life going forward, then that really limits people's ability to learn from trauma and develop resilience, doesn't it?
That's right. I mean, there are two things I want people to know. One is that it's not true that most traumatic experiences leaves a mark on you. In fact, researchers have studied this. The opposite is true. Even traumatic events, most people will completely emerge just fine. absolutely fine. We are actually built for resilience. And of course, a quick look at our history will tell you that. But even if you had doubts that, you know, maybe you thought, oh gosh, they were traumatized. They just didn't, you know, the Brits who survived, you know, the Blitz and so many other things, they were just traumatized. They were just repressed. That's why we don't know about it. Actually, researchers have studied this. No, resilience really is the norm, even for combat veterans. But, you know, there's a brand new study. I love this woman's, I hope I'm not mispronouncing her name, but Kathy Wydom just came out with a new study on this childhood trauma. And she actually does rigorous studies. So they're prospective. She follows a kid before, you know, at the very beginning. She documents to make sure that they actually did go through the occurrence, you know, looks at court records and whatever. And it's not a misremembered event. And then she follows them for 15 years later. I mean, it's incredible work. But anyway, what she found was more important than what you went through is how you think about it in terms of whether it leaves a mark. So if you are convinced you went through childhood trauma, even if you didn't, you're more likely to have problems as an adult than if you did go through a traumatic experience as a child, but don't think of it as traumatic. So it just goes to show telling a generation that they've been traumatized is so much more profound and harmful than even the trauma itself in most instances.
Absolutely. I want to ask you if you could just explain a little bit about how this therapeutic ethos manifests itself in the United States context. So some people might be thinking that you're talking about, you know, the super liberal parent who takes their kid to a therapist, puts them on a therapist's couch and has a conversation between the therapist and a kid. That happens. Kids do go to therapy, but it's more, it's infused the educational system too, hasn't it? And other social arenas and other areas in which children exist and learn and navigate life. There is the therapeutic ethos kind of drips down through all of that, doesn't it? So explain a little bit about how kids come up against this therapeutic ethos. In what areas of life does this take place?
So it's so infused American life that I would say kids are getting it everywhere. And I'll give you an example. In schools, not only have, let me start with this. Since 1986 in America, every decade has seen a near doubling in the expenditure of mental health resources, and the lion's share of it is going to kids and adolescents. Now, these aren't kids with severe disorders. These are bummed out kids. They are treating the well. And let me give you a sense of what's going on in schools. In schools, there is now social emotional learning where teachers routinely play therapist and ask kids to talk about their sad feelings and remember a time when they were sad or left out or bullied or didn't make the team and talk about it. The best-selling parenting books are all invariably written by therapists or guided by therapists, and they all encourage parents to endlessly focus on and solicit their children's feelings. And we are seeing, and then of course, we have an explosion in diagnosis of children. Nearly 42% of the rising generation has a mental health diagnosis. Less than half of them say their mental health is good. 40% of them have already seen a therapist. Now, these are kids. In between the ages of 2 to 8, 1 in 6 kids back in 2016 already had a mental health diagnosis or behavioral diagnosis. Now, those kids weren't on social media. They're ages 2 to 8 back in 2016, right? That was according to the CDC. So we are so awash in psychopathology, and we have convinced ourselves that any deviation of our children means they have a brain problem and we need to rush them to an expert for diagnosis and medication.
Those statistics that you outlaid there are, I mean, the book is full of that kind of stuff, and it's so enlightening and worrying at the same time, and essential information. I think it's essential that people know how extensive this reach into the lives and minds of children has become. And I want to turn it on to the negative impact that this therapeutic intervention can have. And of course, there's this really good part in the book where you discuss the idea, the treatment prevalence complex, the contradiction, where you would expect that the more that an ailment was treated, the less prevalent it would be. So, you know, if you come up with a cure or some form of therapeutic intervention or some form of medical intervention for an ailment or a problem or a psychological issue, you would expect that numbers would go down the more it was treated. But we've had the opposite effect when it comes to things like depression or the mental health crisis among the young. The more that we have these interventions, the greater the spike in these problems. So is it a situation where the mental health industry is just reproducing the problem? I don't mean that in a conspiratorial or cynical way that they're out to do it because they want to make money or whatever, but it is reproducing the problem, isn't it? Could you say a little bit about how that works?
Absolutely. You don't need to be conspiratorial. Any other treatment that's effective at all, the more prevalent it is, the more accessible to people, you should see point prevalence rates of the disease or the disorder go down. We saw this with breast cancer. We've seen this with, you know, infant mortality. We've seen this with every good treatment. As soon as the public gets access to it, the rates go down. With this, across the West, with more treatment, we get more depression. And the question is why? I think two things. I think both that the treatments clearly aren't helping. And by the way, part of the problem is we're treating the well. If we treated the ill, I think the ill are undertreated. They're underserved. They are undermedicated and undertherapized, for lack of a better word. But it's not true of the well. We've never been good at preventive mental health. We're not good at it now. And I looked at the iatrogenic risks of therapy. What were the known harms of therapy? Iatrogenic means, you know, when the healer introduces a harm. And I looked at what the research showed about, you know, the known harms of therapy. And they include things like increasing depression, increasing anxiety, increasing a sense of inefficacy, like I can't do for myself, I have to rely on this expert, alienation from parents. All of these are known effects. And I'll tell you something, one last thing. They have looked at things like burn victims who went to therapy, breast cancer survivors who went to therapy, first responders to catastrophe who went to therapy. And they've done these controlled studies where they sent half the group to therapy and half not, you know, half of them they left alone. And the one, again and again, the ones who went to therapy ended up sadder. They ended up in greater distress. Because sometimes sitting around and talking about the symptoms of PTSD and whether you have it is enough to make your PTSD worse. Talking about your sadness over the loss of a loved one, that can make your sadness worse. And they have studied this over and over. If you leave people alone, they will recover better on their own.
It's such an important point. And I wanted to raise with you something you've said there, and it's also in your book, and it comes across very powerfully in the book, which is, I guess, the cult of incapacity that therapy can nurture. And among the young, you talk about this new generation being quite distinctive from very recent generations in that they seem not to have any self-confidence or any great desire to get big things done. And you have a section in the book that is, the subheading is, "No, we can't." And it's that kind of culture of, we can't do this, we're not really up to this, which is, if you look at Generation Z in those terms, it's quite different to the millennial generation, who were a bit more go-getting and achieved huge things in relation to technology and startups and the internet and Facebook and all that other stuff, some of which is problematic in itself, but we can come on to the technology question in a moment. They were go-getters. They had some element of self-confidence and self-drive, which this new generation seems to lack. Explain a little bit about how you see the relationship there between the growth of the mental health industry and this new generation that seems unable or unwilling to drive itself forward in any social, community-based, or even historical sense, you know, who no longer see themselves as the authors of their own destiny, but rather, I guess, as the playthings of whatever ailment is floating in the ether or whatever sickness is around. They see themselves as the victims of circumstance rather than as the authors of their own historic life, I guess.
That's right. In numbers we've never seen before, this generation has an external, what they call an external locus of control. They don't believe they can make a positive difference in their own lives. And I'll give you an example of someone who pointed this out to me. My friend, I was calling her, she's a research biologist. And I happened to call her for her birthday. And I told her, you know, generally I was writing about this generation. And she said, I have to talk to you about this generation. Every year I employ them in my laboratory. The last 10 years, they are so different. No matter how good their scientific background, they are afraid to run their own experiments. They are afraid to try. I cannot get even the most qualified young people, young adults, to run their own experiments. They say they're getting ready. They're working up to it. And they're constantly updating her on their mental health. And this is a classic side effect of therapy. It often can induce the sense that I don't know how to do things on my own. I have to check in with my therapist. I have to make sure. And of course, it goes without saying, if you need the therapist, then it's worth the risk. The problem is that kids who don't need therapists are being sent to therapy or getting it from school very young when they're just learning how to take risks. So now we've got a rising generation that won't take any risks. They're afraid to drive. Boys of 17 say driving is scary. We've never heard this before. It's not that they're not getting their license just because they're lazy. They actually say they're afraid of driving.
It is extraordinary. The place I notice it most of all is on campuses here in the UK. I don't think we're as far down the road as you guys. We're pretty far down the road, however, of the mental health industry. And I notice it on campuses when I go to do talks and, you know, there's the usual stuff. There'll be a protest. People will say, we don't want this hate speaker on campus. You've experienced similar yourself, I know, for some of the things that you've said and some of the things that you've written. But what I've noticed when I'm talking to some of these young people who might be 18, 19, 20, they do seem very different to me than even the young kids I was talking to 10 years ago, 15 years ago, or 20 years ago, even to the, you know, an inability to make eye contact, for example, or a nervousness or a sense of neurosis. And of course, a real reluctance to engage in risky discussion or risky debate, you know, that might be seen as incredibly damaging.
Right, because no one forced them to make eye contact. No one told them to do things that they were afraid of. Instead, they were told, if you don't like it, avoid it. And that made it harder and worse. They were told, if this makes you nervous, don't worry, we can avoid it. If you're afraid, if you have testing anxiety, okay, it's called, you're nervous about a test, it's called testing anxiety, and I'll write you a note so you don't have to do it. Or you can do it in twice the time. We coddled. What we did was we helped them avoid the things where they were afraid of, and then it made those fears worse.
And it's so clear to me that it has grown exponentially with the mental health industry, because what we do have on campuses in the UK is mental health days, mental health inductions. You know, you get these kids coming to campus and they are almost instantly socialized into the belief, if they hadn't already been through the school system, socialized into the belief that university is going to be an awfully terrible place for them. It's going to be difficult. They probably have a mental health problem, even if they haven't had it diagnosed. They're going to be feeling fragile. They're going to need help. They're socialized into that from the very beginning. But I wanted to ask you about, there's this kind of contradictory process, and you touch on this in the book as well, where on the one hand, it is clearly very debilitating to tell young kids and kids who are moving into adulthood, to tell them that they're weak, they're fragile, they're vulnerable, they will always need the help of the expert class. That's clearly very debilitating. But there's the contradictory process where there is also an element, a system of social reward for public declarations of mental ill health. And I've noticed this on campuses too. I remember vividly, I went to the pub with some of the students I'd been given a talk to. And in my talk, I had raised questions about the mental health crisis as part of a broader discussion. And these kids were taking out their antidepressants and putting them on the table and saying, look, I'm on this, I'm on that. And it just struck me as very odd that you would quite ostentatiously demonstrate in a public place how reliant you are on medical assistance to get through everyday life. There seemed to be a kind of almost like a boasting element to it. So I wonder if you could talk about the social reward that some people receive as part of this.
That's right. We have convinced these kids that they are unwell, and we have also convinced them that the greatest thing about them is their disability. Now, most of them are not disabled and they're not disordered, but they are leaning into these things and they are defining themselves by that. Oh, I can't get up for work. Look, most of us wake up in the morning and we don't feel like we can get to work, but we push through. And here's the important thing. If you really have major depressive disorder, you might not be able to get up, but the rest of us can. That's the thing. This isn't to say that nobody needs those medications, but at the rates that we're seeing their use, they don't make any sense. And more importantly, we're giving them to kids who are just developing the emotional musculature to try. So when you put a young person on these things before they've ever done anything hard or made it through a bad patch of you know, the doldrums or are feeling sad about things, not to minimize it, it's terrible to be a teenager in so many ways. But if they've never made it through that gauntlet, they might never know they can. We just pour on this emotional snowsuit and send them out into the world. Well, no wonder they feel they can't do anything. They've been told by everyone around them, you can't. You know, in America, we have these wellness centers now at every university. And we tell them they need to constantly be focusing on their coping mechanisms, on focusing on emotional regulation. Have you done your breathing techniques? Have you tried meditation? We are putting the lens so that they are always focused inward. The lens is always inward. Look at yourself, look at yourself, look at yourself. And the problem is, if we want them to actually be happy, we'd be doing the opposite. We'd be saying, sending them out into the world and say, go do things, develop skills, develop competency, give things a try, make some friends. All of that will make you much happier than thinking about yourself.
That's very well put. Do you think some people, not necessarily kids, but maybe as they get older and certainly young adults, do you think sometimes they covet a mental health diagnosis almost as like a comfort blanket or I guess a moral shield against taking moral responsibility for their lives? There was a really interesting piece on the BBC News website here in Britain a few years ago, where a doctor described how more and more young adults were coming into the office and they were saying, look, can I have a bipolar disorder diagnosis, please? I'm convinced I've got it. Can I have one? And the doctor was making the point that it felt like, firstly, that it had become a fashionable disease. I do quote marks around that. It's become more common to see it talked about in popular culture. But also it was a way of them explaining every problem in their life. So the fact that they couldn't hold down that job or hold down that relationship, or the fact that they didn't feel in control of their emotions or their life itself. If they could just have this diagnosis, it would explain everything. Do you think there's an element where people seek out a diagnosis for that reason?
Absolutely. Look, life is full of pains, right? The pain of unrequited affection, someone seeming angry with you, someone seeming disappointed in you. There is so much pain we have to repress in daily life. And here's the problem. Young people don't know that that's normal. They don't know that feeling like, oh, I can't face work today is completely normal. And if we don't tell them that they can, I mean, look, my last book, Irreversible Damage, was effectively about a young generation that had convinced themselves they had a disorder that they couldn't possibly have had, which is gender dysphoria. It's the severe distress in one's biological sex. Why did they not have it? Because it was overwhelmingly male. It was almost non-existent among females. And when it did occur in females, it didn't come on in adolescence. It came on in little kids. Right? So almost none of them had this thing, but they were able to convince themselves because our minds are so good at fooling us, especially about our vulnerabilities. That's why these kids need the message. It's not because none of them will ever have an anxiety disorder. Of course, some of them will, but we have to at least try to winnow the ones who are actually really severely suffering from the vast majority who will be just fine if we tell them and give them permission to reach for their inner resources. And those inner resources are going to do them much better in the future than a diagnosis and medication they don't need.
Hi, it's Brendan here. I just wanted to remind you that you can still buy my book. It's called A Heretic's Manifesto, Essays on the Unsayable. And I've really been blown away by the response to it from readers, reviewers, Spike supporters. People really like this book and I think you're going to like it too. It covers all the insanities of our time, from climate change hysteria through to COVID authoritarianism, through to the trans ideology. And it basically makes the case for more freedom of speech, more debate, and more heretical thinking to challenge the conformism of our times. So what are you waiting for? Go to Amazon right now and order my book, A Heretic's Manifesto, Essays on the Unsayable. And now, on with the show. Yeah, another contradictory element in this, or perhaps it's not contradictory, but you explore this in the book too, is the some of the nature of this new generation, having gone through the mental health industry and what they're like. And it does seem quite odd at times, because they do seem very politically radical, quite tub-thumping. You know, they're all over social media at the moment. You know, they're tweeting about Gaza morning, noon and night. And some of them have even expressed sympathy for Hamas, which is a whole other nightmarish ball game that we could or could not get into. But they did, on one level, they seem quite radical and out there and almost uncontrolled politically. Like, they throw all these ideas around and don't think about the meaning of them or the consequences of them. But on the other hand, they're quite obedient to authority, which you would expect if, you know, given that their whole personality, if that's how they consider their mental health diagnosis, comes from the new gods of therapy, you know, the new expert class, this new priestly elite, which decrees you have this, you have that. It makes sense that they would be obedient to authority and almost reliant on authority for validation. They seek validation from a new medico establishment. So there's a kind of weird thing going on, isn't there, where you've got these kids who dye their hair purple and they seem quite reckless and daring and radical, but at the same time, they require the diagnoses, the interventions, the validation of a whole new system of authority.
Right. So the two go together. They're not in contradiction. And here's why. Because they're out looking for daddy. They're not looking to be in charge. They're looking for a radical source to govern their lives and tell them what to do. And they're finding the most radical sources. You know, if they were daring, you know what they would do? They would take a job. They would take on a romantic relationship, a strong one, and maybe even get married. They would have children. Those things are hard and ultimately rewarding, right? That's what it means to be an adult. They would, you know, move out of their parents' house, take a chance on in an area they've never, you know, take a job they've never thought they could do. That's real bravery. But listening to extremists and go running from daddy, who give you the most extreme rules for life, and being out there screaming in people's faces, that's not actual bravery. They're just lemmings following each other. And they're looking for the most radical sources, partly because their parents didn't give them authority at home. Kids need authority. And I believe mental health professionals so undermined parents' confidence that they knew what they were doing with their own children. They so undermined our confidence that we weren't authorities in our own home. And these kids grew up and they went looking for someone to tell them what to do. And they find it in the most radical sources.
It's such an important point. And on that question of parental sovereignty or the sovereignty of the family home, you know, our generation and, of course, older generations will know that, you know, the authority of your parents was so important in a child's life and important in the process of becoming an adult. Absolutely essential. And you do wonder how people even manage to become adults if they don't have that guidance and that authority and that kind of sovereignty where their parents get to enjoy the right to discipline their kids and to guide them and to infuse them with certain ways of thinking or certain ideas or a certain kind of approach to society, all those things that parents have done for a very long time. And that's kind of undermined when the mental health industry steps in and says, we know better than you do how your kids should be raised. But I did want to ask you, and you touch on this in the book too, what kind of parents are doing this? So, for example, in the American context, the working class parents in middle America, you know, the dad's off making cars perhaps, and the mum might work in a local store, and they're quite traditional, and they might be Christians. Are they doing this? Is the therapy industry impacting on their kids, or is it more without wanting to caricature, is it more the kind of liberal elites, the coastal elites, the kind of wealthier parents who might be a bit more time rich, a bit more, less confident? What kind of parents are doing this?
So it's more liberal elites. It's more people who tend to rely on experts and believe in expertise. And I'll give you a statistic to back this up. There's a wonderful academic psychologist who studies these generations, Jean Twenge. She came out with a new book called Generations. And one of the things she found, and she is no conservative, but she found that although teenage girls' mental health was the worst overall, teenage boys from liberal families had worse mental health than teenage girls from conservative families in America. And part of the reason is because they get more authority from their parents, and they aren't and conservative families aren't as quick to let the expert in the door and put them in charge of the children. And that was the mistake. It's not that conservative parents are better or liberal parents, you know, it's nor that they care more, of course. I mean, we're pouring hours into our children, but we've picked the wrong gurus. We're letting people, we have no proof that most of these people are childless. Many of them are childless. We've never seen their kids very often. I'd like to meet some of their kids. Some of their kids, when I do look into it, it's not what you'd want to raise. And yet we're completely relying on them as our gurus to guide our parenting. And I just want to say, like, when we talk about what does it mean to raise a good kid or a good person to adulthood, on this, I'm very clear. What it means is someone with your values who is a load-bearing wall. Other people can rely on this person to show up for work, to be a good spouse, to be a good parent. Someone your neighbors can rely on, that is what we want to create. And that's what we're not creating. And we need to turn this around.
In relation to the parenting question, just one more question on that. How much do you think this speaks to a broader, I'm almost reluctant to say this, tyranny of expertise? Now, I think expertise can be a brilliant thing, right? If I break my iPhone, I'm going to bring it to I can't fix that. I'm going to bring it to an expert. If I break my leg, I'm going to go and see a really good doctor. I'm not going to call up a friend of mine because he won't know what to do with it. So expertise is a wonderful thing. It is essential to the functioning of society. But by the tyranny of expertise, I guess I mean, well, these new gurus that you talk about, therapeutic gurus, lifestyle gurus, you know, you can't swing a bag in a bookshop these days without hitting 10 books saying, how to recover from divorce, you know, why you shouldn't have children or whatever, all sorts of advice just bombarding us all the time, all of it basically saying to us, you can't run your life, so let us run it for you. Do you think there's this kind of, this new layer of, in some instances, phony expertise has risen? And it might enrich some of the people who do it, but it has a devastating impact on sections of society.
That's exactly right. And here's the key. You need your iPhone to be fixed by an expert because of the nature of the iPhone. Human beings have been raising great people, amazing adults for generations, for thousands of years, right? I mean, the idea that we need an expert in the brain, by the way, nobody knows very much about brains and emotion regulation, as anyone with any integrity will tell you who's an expert in the subject. I mean, our knowledge of the human brain is so crude, okay? And these phony experts who claim that you need to know about your child's brain to be a good parent, it's nonsense, it's unhelpful, and it's undermining parents' instincts that they know what's right for their child. If parents are looking for experts, they should look to people who have actually raised good kids to adulthood. Those people have more to say on the subject than any of these phony experts.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, I want to ask you about a culture of anxiety. There are so many aspects of anxiety that you touch upon in the book, one being climate anxiety. And when I speak at schools or universities, the number of young people I meet who suffer from climate anxiety is extraordinary. And, you know, the impact of people like Greta Thunberg and others who say the planet is on fire, which technically speaking is not true, or, you know, the house is on fire, we're all going to die, we don't have a future. But there are other forms of anxiety too. And it does seem sometimes that we live in an age of anxiety. And this, I guess, impacts not only on kids, but on adults too. You know, everything is like this malarial shifting from one crisis to another, from one apocalyptic scenario to another apocalyptic scenario. We seem to have lost the knack to discuss the problems that face humanity in a rational, calm, solutions-driven way, and instead everything becomes evidence of an end-of-world situation. So how much do you think that anxious age contributes to a feeling amongst the new generation that they live in a very peculiar time and they might not get through it and they certainly shouldn't have kids in the future? Do you think anxiety plays a big role there?
Absolutely. It's entirely responsible for this, in fact. These kids have an unhealthy life, and part of the unhealthy life is being constantly told all that everything's going to end, that if a president their parents don't like is elected, we're going to end up with a tyranny, that COVID, we've never gone through anything like this before, we've never had a pandemic before, totally untrue. But also cutting them off, and of course the environment, you know, the world's going to end. Look, but we're also cutting them off from sources of meaning, like their grandparents and their grandparents' stories. Those are more helpful in facing your future because it's the only proof that your genetic material is strong, that people in your line went through hard things and you can too. We have cut them off from all the good things, the friendships, the cousins, the more children, you know, siblings, all the good things. And we have filled them with, you know, the tech, which has given them so much anxiety, the you know, everything from the cortisol hits to the, you know, the dopamine rush, the cycle of addiction we've handed them. Through social media, we have absolutely, you know, overloaded them with all kinds of stress. And instead, they need to put down their phones and get out into the world. And here's the kicker. No mental health experts tell you this because it doesn't require them. It doesn't give them a role. They don't have a role in fixing these kids' lives. The kids don't need them. We just need to get the bad things out of their way, give them the good, and just get out of the kids' way. If we do that, if we surround them with a good environment, they're going to be just fine. But to do that, parents need authority. And that's why it's so bad that the experts undermine parents' authority, because they'll never tell the kid to put away the phone. They'll never take it away if parents don't have the authority to do it.
There's such a powerful part in the book, which really made me think about some issues in a new way, where you talk about how curiously silent the mental health experts were. Firstly, during lockdown, they seemed to have very little to say about the continued confinement of kids across much of the Western world, across much of the world, in fact, for long periods of time, missing school, missing their school friends. These supposed experts in kids' problems didn't seem to have much to say about that. And you also point out that they are often very reluctant to criticize the rise of technology and the spread of mobile phones. And in fact, they will often say that the threat posed by social media and constant engagement with one's phone, they will often say that's exaggerated, relax, it's not that big a problem. It's very interesting. But I did want to ask you specifically about tech. I just wanted to get a few of your, because I find myself flitting between agreeing that social media, kids being on social media all day long is very bad, and I see my nieces and nephews on there all the time, and it does worry me. But then also wondering if the tendency of some commentators to blame technology alone, as if removing the phone would fix all the problems, banning the phone in schools, which is current discussion here in the UK, would fix all the problems. I wonder if they are over-reliant on the technological explanation for what is a much broader historical social problem, as you describe well in your book. So how do you see technology contributing to it?
So technology's been terrible, and I think banning it from schools is a no-brainer. It's so obvious. We've known this for now 8 years, the harms that are coming from social media. I wrote a whole book about, you know, one contagion that's passed, you know, this idea that they're all transgender was passed through social media largely. And there's no question that these phones are doing these kids no good, and there's no reason they should have them during the school day. So where were the mental health experts? This was the easiest thing in the world. And I think part of the reason that they didn't say anything was because they didn't have a role, really. It didn't give them a continuing role over parents and families. Look, they have participated and overseen the worst downward spiral in adolescent mental health we have seen. But teenage mental health has been getting worse since the 1950s. We now have so many young kids diagnosed. I can tell you in America, as early as 2016, 1 in 6 2 to 8-year-olds had a diagnosis. That wasn't from social media. Now, the question, because they weren't on it, but here's the question, right? Why does everyone blame tech? Well, tech's been terrible, but also it's much easier because everybody hates tech. We all think it's done all kinds of terrible things. It's much harder to point the finger at the mental health experts who are now claiming they're going to solve the problem they have overseen and only made worse.
That's a very fair analysis, I think. Okay, Abigail, I've got one more question I want to put to you. And you've mentioned a couple of times your last book, also excellent, also highly recommended, Irreversible Damage, The Transgender Craze Seducing Our Daughters. Everyone should read it. It's a very good discussion of, I would call it the trans cult and the sway that it holds over increasing numbers of young women and the hysterical self-destructive behavior that the ideology of gender dysphoria can give rise to. But what I want to ask you about is just about the importance of freedom of speech on all of these questions, because you experienced a lot of pushback for your book on the transgender craze, attempted cancellations, young people at Amazon saying that they didn't want to sell it, the kind of young people whose qualities you describe very well in your new book, intolerant, fearful, and so on. And there is huge pushback against anyone, particularly any woman, who raises questions about the impact of the ideology of transgenderism on young people, on women's rights, on women's equality. One only needs to look at the demonization of J.K. Rowling, which we see every single day, and numerous other so-called TERFs who are often being blacklisted from university campuses, no platformed, shunned from polite society. There is this unwillingness across society, not only amongst the young, to grapple openly and freely with difficult topics facing young people and people more broadly. It's really important that we push back against that, isn't it? Could you just say something about your own personal experience of attempted cancellation and why you think it's a problem when that happens?
Sure. So the problem is that tech has so much power and they have so many levers for suppressing you. So Target.com used to sell my book. Then there was outcry. They removed the book. There was great outcry. They removed the book. The activists pressured them to remove the book. And then they put it back. But they put it back only for a week. And then they deleted it again. And it's never been back. And that's the kind of, this is so easy. It takes a second for them to do this. But for people to organize is much harder. So, you know, all these big tech firms have been so effective at, you know, Amazon played all these games with my book. It still plays games with my books. And no book, as far as I know, has ever recommended one of mine on Amazon. You know, it says, you know, readers who enjoyed this book might also enjoy their, no matter how well your book sells. And my book is currently in, I don't know, top 30 book on all books on Amazon, but no book will recommend it because these are just the many, many levers and they're much faster than human beings can sort of keep up with. It's very, very hard to keep up with all the, you know, tech levers that can suppress ideas. It's very dangerous. And I would just say that, you know, I don't know very much about AI other than, you know, what the layperson has reading about it, but it's alarming to think that this could get even more sophisticated because it's already beguiling us and confusing us and, you know, these levers. And I just think, you know, from Wikipedia to Amazon to so many different tech companies that really push us to think a certain way and suppress ideas that that you know, question those things. It's frightening. I mean, we really do have to oppose, you know, I do think that we need to, you know, oppose censorship wherever we find it, but especially a censorship of books, of articles. I mean, even getting the ideas out, it's become very, very difficult.
Abigail, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Brendan O'Neill Show. We'll be back with another guest and more discussion. Don't forget to subscribe. And in the meantime, keep reading Spiked at www.spiked-online.com.